The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. While based in London for Newsweek, Donna Foote reported on the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan's Benazir Bhutto, tensions in the Middle East, the troubles in Northern Ireland, Princess Diana and the British royal family, and UK politics and culture. While deputy bureau chief in Los Angeles, she covered the Rodney King riots and both the criminal and civil trials of O.J. Simpson. She also wrote extensively on education, health, and justice issues. In her new book, Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America, Foote tells the story of how we educate our poorest students through the eyes and the experiences of our most privileged. The story is set in South Los Angeles at Locke High School, an institution founded in 1967 in the spirit of renewal that followed the devastating Watts riots, but that, four decades on, still resembles a prison as much as a school. In Slate magazine, Sarah Mosley wrote, "Foote's account couldn't be better timed. The lessons on display are especially important for an era in which a ruthless focus on student outcomes risks overlooking a key ingredient of that enterprise, inputs for teachers who need all the help they can get as they face an educational culture of new pressures and expectations along with age-old challenges." Foote's fine-grained account of Locke supplies the larger context and a corrective. In conversation with Donna tonight is Paul Cummins, a much-lauded visionary in the field of education. Paul was the primary founder and headmaster of the Crossroads School. He is currently the executive director of the New Visions Foundation. In addition, he is the primary founder of New Roads School, a co-founder of Camino Nuevo Charter Academy, the creator of CEO, the Center for Educational Opportunity, and also the founder of Families Helping Families, which redirects low-income families into life-changing new directions. He's also an author, the author of many books, including a biography on Herbert Zipper, Dachau Song, the 20th Century Odyssey of Herbert Zipper. I'm sure you've noticed Zipper Hall up the street. That's who it's named after. And his latest book is Two Americas, Two Educations, Funding Quality Schools for All Students. Please join me in welcoming Donna Foote and Paul Cummins to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I was backstage and I didn't get to see the hands go up of how many people here are teachers and educators. Would you mind doing it one more time just for Donna and me? Wow. Okay. Great. And how many of you have had a chance to read Donna's book yet? Good. Okay. Well, for those of you who haven't, it's a wonderful book and it's kind of a rare opportunity to go inside the classroom of some difficult schools, in this case, a difficult school, and to see what it's like for classroom teachers. So my first question to you, Donna, is what possessed you to write this book, and what was the process? Can you tell us how it happened?
Well, I had been working at Newsweek and was aware of Wendy Kopp from the very beginning and was fascinated by this idea that she had in her senior year at Princeton to start a teacher corps. So I kept clips and thought, I'd like to investigate this. Never really got around to it, didn't find a good peg. Until the spring of 2005, when I read a little news clip that said 12% of the graduating class from Yale had applied to Teach for America, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. At the same time, a very dear friend had just started teaching at Locke High School, and she was telling me the problems that she was having. This was a mid-career switch for her. And she invited me to come and to help. And I got to her English classroom, and Liza was doing k-at-cat, k-at-cat. And these were ninth graders. So after 50 minutes, it was clear to me that they couldn't read. The same day, Liza told me that Teach for America was having their summer training institute at Locke. And I thought, wow, wouldn't that be interesting to look at how we educate our poorest and lowest performing students through the eyes of our most privileged students. And so the book was born.
during your 1 year at the school, let me rephrase it. Were you shocked to read in the paper a couple weeks ago of the trouble that took place at Locke, the violence?
Not at all, really. I think, as one of the teachers in the book, Chad Solio, who's now at a Green Dot, had mentioned to me, the real news behind the headlines was that these kids can't read. They're, 11% are proficient in language arts, and 2% are proficient in algebra. So part of what happened in Locke, I think, is of course racial tensions, which are always there when you have two large minority groups. And part of it is what happens when kids aren't educated and they're not occupied and there's not enough adults in charge.
I was at Crenshaw last year, and a bunch of kids were milling around in the halls, and I was talking to the security guard about this and expressing a little bit of concern, and he said, well, Paul, don't you understand? School, for a lot of these kids, is not a place where they come to get an education. This is where they do business, and that, which was a little stunning comment. Did you see anything yourself that year that showed you how difficult it is to teach, what the teaching conditions are like? And does an incident come to mind that you could read to us tonight from observing something like that?
Yeah, Paul, every day was difficult for every teacher. We have no idea what a difficult job this is, or I didn't, certainly. Because teachers are being asked to be much more than instructors. They're referees, they're coaches, they're psychologists. It's an unbelievable job. But let me read you the very opening of the book, which is the first full day of September 2005. And it's the very first page, and this is Rochelle Snyder, who I don't think is here tonight, but this is what happened to her on the day of a lockdown. When the lights went off in room 241 during her fourth period special ed biology class, Rochelle didn't think anything of it. The bells seemed to ring constantly at Locke High School. Why should she expect the lights to work? This Monday was the first day of the first full week of the first year of the first job of her professional life. Never mind that she had had only 5 weeks of training. Over the summer, Rochelle Snyder, psychology major and former captain of the University of Pennsylvania soccer team, had become Miss Snyder, or sometimes just Miss, special education teacher at Locke High School in Watts. The transition had been surprisingly easy to make. Except for the 15 pounds she gained, Teach for America's Institute, aka boot camp, didn't bother her. It was like soccer training. She woke up early, worked hard, got the job done. She was exhausted. They all were. But during breaks, when other teachers in training were having panic attacks, Rochelle would catnap on the concrete benches that lined the walkway along Locke's inner quad, her long blonde hair bunched up beneath her head like a pillow, trousers rolled up, her pale skin bathed in the harsh white light of the LA sun. The day had started well. She'd gotten to school early, reviewed her lesson plan, and made sure that the desks were still arranged in clusters of four, exactly the way she'd left them on Friday. The morning had flown by. The kids in the early periods were attentive, eager to please. She particularly liked her girl-heavy third period. 3 14-year-olds had children of their own at home, and a fourth was pregnant. She found that out after she had the kids make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches as a way to introduce the idea of steps and procedures in science. "You think I don't know how to make peanut butter sandwiches?" asked one girl. "I got a baby at home, and he always be screaming for them." Maybe it was Rochelle's blonde hair and light blue eyes. The girls seemed drawn to her. Some even brought their friends to the classroom to get a look. "See," they squealed, "she looks just like a Barbie doll." Rochelle couldn't access their computerized individual education programs, IEPs, the government-mandated plans of instruction and services specially tailored to meet the specific needs of each student with a diagnosed learning disability. So she had no way of knowing how these smart, streetwise kids, girls, had come to be sitting there, hanging on her every word. She had a pretty good idea how the 20 boys in her fourth period class got there. They were in special ed because their behavior interfered with their ability to learn. It was certainly interfering with her ability to teach. These boys were rude, crude, and disrespectful. She didn't think it had anything to do with her gender, her race, or her youth. She was reasonably certain that they behaved badly with every authority figure. It was only 5 days into the school year, and she felt she was already losing control of period four. She had been wrestling with how to handle all her special ed kids, but these boys were especially troubling. Her instinct was to try to win them over with kindness. They'd probably had enough tough single women in their lives. She wanted to show them something else. Do I continue to be nice? If I do, will they break me? As the boys straggled in, shorts hanging low on their hips, T-shirts on inside out, some with do-rags hugging their heads, she felt tense. She worried about two of her African-American students, cousins Martel and D'Angelo, who'd almost gotten jumped on their way to school the Friday before. The boys had come into class that day subdued, scared to leave the building unless she walked them out. What will they be like today? Then there was Raul. Last week, she'd handed out a survey asking generic questions about the kids' goals and attitudes toward school. Raul's response stopped her cold. He said he hated teachers and liked to kill. He drew a picture of a building with a boy on top firing a rifle. The bubble said, "Die, fucker." There were stick figures on the ground running away from the words, "kill, kill, kill." Rochelle grabbed the seating chart and was surprised to find that the artist was a quiet little Latino kid, one of the few boys in class who didn't cause trouble. He kept his head down and his eyes averted. She didn't think he was looking for attention with his threatening handiwork. She thought he was an emotionally disturbed boy who needed help. She alerted the principal, Dr. Frank Wells, immediately. He seemed on top of things. Raul was one of some 3,100 kids in his charge. Will Raul be in class today? Will he have killing on his mind? 5-10 minutes had passed before everyone was seated. The day's lesson was about the scientific method. The kids were going to test the manufacturer's claim that the fertilizer Miracle-Gro was guaranteed to produce especially hardy plants. Each group of four was given seeds, a pot of soil, and a bucket of water. Only half the class had shown up, but Rochelle was actually relieved. The fewer there were, the more easily she could maintain control. After explaining the project, she'd moved from group to group, praising those busy at work, gently scolding those who were fooling around. The room hummed with the sound of the kids' voices as they prepared their pots. Rochelle began to relax. Then the lights went off. At first, it didn't seem like cause for alarm. But within minutes, Rochelle could hear the sound of kids running up and down the stairwell and along the hallway outside her room. Her students heard the commotion, too. Suddenly, the vibe in the classroom changed. The kids were uneasy, distracted. The air felt charged, the room dangerous. Rochelle peeked out the door. Students were literally running wild, shouting and jumping one another in the darkness. Graffiti artists had whipped out their markers and were signing the walls with gleeful abandon. The security guard, who usually sat within 10 feet of Rochelle's room, was missing. She slammed the door shut. "You are not leaving," she said to her students, her voice rising in fear. "Sit down. Let's get back to work." But the kids were unsettled. Some were at the door, clamoring to get out. Others circled the desks, itching for trouble. When told to sit, they refused. When ordered to continue working, they said the experiment sucked. Rochelle tried to keep teaching. As she bent over to inspect one kid's pot, her T-shirt inched up her back, revealing a patch of bare white flesh above her hip huggers. Dante, a tall, skinny black boy, made a farting noise. The classroom erupted in laughter. Encouraged, he announced in a high-pitched voice that he had to pee. Rochelle told him he was forbidden to leave the classroom. Dante insisted that if he was not allowed to leave, he would pee in the classroom. As he began to lower his pants, the kids taunted him. "It's so small. Your dick is so small." They dared him to make good on his threat. "She wants you. She wants to see you. Do it. Do it. You want to do it?" they chanted. He did it. Dante urinated in a water bucket right in the middle of Miss Snyder's class. Rochelle ordered the entire class out of the room. "You guys need to leave now. Dante, you need to stay." "I want to transfer out of this class," said one boy as he left the room. "It sucks." "What about me?" pleaded Dante. "Can I get out of here?"
Wow. I wonder if the graduating class from Yale, if they read that, the 12% of them are going to sign up for Teach for America after reading that particular incident. Speaking about Teach for America, is it possible for fresh out of college with a short period of preparation for this army of teachers to go out there and actually have a positive impact in really tough schools and help address the achievement gap, do you believe?
Well, the Teach for America has a two-pronged theory of change. I don't think it's possible, and I would imagine that Teach for America would agree that it's possible to close the achievement gap by sending a small core, 5,000 or so, relatively inexperienced teachers into classrooms where the needs are the greatest. However, Teach for America does have a two-pronged theory of change. And the idea is that in the short term, there will be a catalytic change in that by choosing very carefully their candidates who they send into the classrooms, they will send the best and the brightest who will, with their brains and energy, have a dramatic impact on student achievement over the two years that they are in the classroom. But the second prong of the theory of change is that these Teach for America teachers will be so transformed by their experience that they will, whatever they do once they leave the classroom, be agents of change. And whether they be lawyers or doctors or politicians or reporters, they will be the people who will force the change. And we're beginning to see some of that. If you look around the landscape of education reform, you'll see lots of TFA alums. And the Washington Post calls it the TFA insurgency, in fact. Mm-hmm. Last year, Michelle Rhee was named D.C. Chancellor's of Schools, and she's a Teach for America alum. And another good example is the KIPP Schools, Knowledge is Power program, which is a string of charter schools, which I'm sure you're familiar with, started by TFA alums and are having tremendous success.
Are there any TFA alums here who are now doing things other than teaching or are planning for careers in education where you're moving out of the classroom? I know at least a couple are. Yeah. Right. Well, we're talking about reforming public education. After your year at Locke, what do you think it's going to take to make it possible for teachers to teach in conditions like the conditions that you describe at this school? Because Locke is not an aberration. There are schools like Locke all over the city and all over the country. So what's it going to take to make it possible for teachers to teach and consequently students to learn?
Oh, that's a big question.
I know, it's a big one.
If I knew the answer.
Yeah.
If anyone,
let's kick that one around. Let's kick that one around a little bit.
Well, first of all, I think that the American public has to, look at this problem and demand change, okay? So number one, we have to make education a priority in this country because it's not just the children at Locke or in inner city schools or poor rural areas that are at risk. 1.23 million kids dropped out of high school this year. 70% of our children graduate within 4 years. That's not good. And in terms of our ranking among the industrialized nations, we're 19. Right. So we are 25 years after a nation at risk. So that would be my first point. I think we have to really tackle this problem.
Which is why the what you said about the importance of TFA, the second point that you made, is that these TFA graduates or alums, once they've taught their 2 years in tough schools, when they go out into the world, they're going to be telling the world a story that the world so far, or the United States, doesn't particularly want to hear. And that is that there, and this is a plug now for my latest book, that there really are not only two Americas, but there's two educations that are taking place in those two Americas. And my concern is that that we've been sold by a lot of people a bill of goods that the problem is not funding. And that, I hear this all the time, that you don't solve problems by throwing money at it. You've all heard that one. Or that the kinds of problems we have can't be solved by money, that has to be better administration, and so on. And so let me just give one example of why I think that's false. I've been playing a game for the last 5 years. Every time I talk to anybody in LAUSD, I ask them what the per pupil expenditure is, and I get a different answer from everybody I've ever talked to. And every book that I read has a different number. But right now it seems to be somewhere, depending on who you talk to, between $8,000 and $10,000 per pupil. Some people say it's even 11. Some people say 7. I've talked to principals that are saying 7. Boy, I'd be thrilled if I had 7. And so God knows what the number is. But let's just split all those differences and call it 9. Across town, in the private school that I used to be the headmaster of, Crossroads School, they'll be spending $27,000 per pupil next year. And that's a big difference. And you can do a lot with $27,000 per pupil that you can't do with $9,000. So we were talking about how many kids graduate. And at one of the local inner city schools, I asked the principal, I said, well, how many of your kids go on to college? And he said, I don't know. And I said, what do you mean you don't know? And he said, well, we don't have a college counselor per se, and the person who's doing the college counseling, can't track these kids, and we just don't know. And I said, well, what's your best guess? And he said, he also told me that they had 1,800 kids in the ninth grade 4 years before this, a little less than 900 of those kids in the 12th grade. Excuse me. And I said, well, how many of those 900 do you think go on to college? And he said, well, he said, my best guess is would be based on how many of them come by the guidance office to ask for college scholarship forms. I said, well, how many? He said, usually a little less than 300. And I said, well, what's your best guess of those 300, how many actually fill them out, mail them in, get accepted by college, and enroll the following September? He said, best guess, 10%. I said, you mean 30 students? He said, yeah. So I said, you're telling me that out of your original 1,800 ninth graders, your best guess is that 30 of them are going on to college? I mean, I was stunned. And he said, yeah. So what's it going to change to take that? Well, for one thing, it would be nice to have enough money to hire a college guidance counselor so that you could encourage kids starting in the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades to go to college. The kids at Crossroads, most of them visit a college. And they start talking about which college they're going to go to in the 10th grade. It's just sort of a given that they're going to go to college. At the inner city schools, that isn't the case. And you can go right down the list. I mentioned Crenshaw earlier. I spent a year there trying to help a little bit. And they have a beautiful dance studio, but no dance teacher. And I can just, one after another, things that you get at the one school, you don't get at the other. And it is a matter of money. And the money is there in our society. It's just that our priorities are all screwed up.
Well, I agree. Excuse me. Money is always good. But I, for my money, I would like to see teachers be given the money. I think Teach for America has shown us one very important lesson among many, and that is if you attach status and prestige to a job of teaching, you can attract the best and the brightest to this profession. And I think what's happened is it's difficult to be a teacher and live on a salary and raise a family, especially if you're, you know, a single breadwinner family. And, you know, I think if we started paying our teachers like we paid investment bankers, I think our problems would go away.
Yeah, agreed. Well, when I'm asked by people, what do you think it would take, excuse me for having my back to people over here, but I'm trying to look at you and ask questions. When people ask me, what do you think it would take to improve our public schools, I say, well, there's three things I can think of right away that I would do, and I'm focusing primarily on inner city schools and low-income schools, and that is I'd cut the class size in half so that the teachers can teach. My first year of teaching at a private school, I taught four sections of 12th grade English, and I had 12 and 13 kids in each section. So I had a total of 48 kids to teach. I could assign an essay every week, get it corrected, hand it back. Those kids wrote about 30 essays that year. They all also had about 15 paperback novels and collections of poetry and anthologies of plays to take home. I could teach, and it was a joy. But give me five classes a day of 35, 40, 45 kids and tell me to teach English, and then say, oh, by the way, we don't have any books for them to take home. You're going to have to Xerox excerpts from novels instead of having the kid read the novel. That's not teaching. So what would I do? I'd cut the class size in half, which means you'd have to hire 100% more teachers in those schools. But we're having a hard time attracting people to teaching, so I'd bump the pay scale by $25,000-$50,000. Just bam, first thing to do. So where's that money going to come from? Well, that's the subject of my book. It would come from corporations paying their fair share of taxes. It would come from progressive income taxes. It would come from estate taxes. It would come from reducing our obscene defense budget. It would come from a lot of places. The money is there in our society. You know?
I agree.
And that's just the start. I mean, just to have quality teachers in classrooms where they can actually teach, that's just the start. Then if you were going to do it right, you'd hire even more teachers so that every kid in Locke and Manual Arts and Crenshaw and you name it would have the rich curriculum that they would get in any private school in this country, that they'd have choices in all the arts and they'd have community service programs and environmental ed trips. You know, one of the things that we desperately need to do, obviously, is to take better care of our environment. Well, if you graduate generations of kids who have never slept under the stars, never walked through a forest, never been out on the ocean, how are they going to want to save a planet that they've never had any kind of a relationship with? They've never had any direct experience. Once you've walked through a redwood forest, you have a whole different attitude towards the cutting down of trees. And then the destruction of the rainforest starts to mean something to you. Well, how many inner city kids get to take these kinds of field trips that are just sort of commonplace in private schools? It's just what happens in private schools. Mm-hmm. So it is money. A lot of it is money. And we've got to figure out, you know, some way of raising the consciousness of the American public that we're doing a terrible disservice to our children. I remember reading a line that just knocked me out by a British writer, Marina Warner. Someone was pointing this disparity of not only wealth, but the quality of education provided to young people in America. And she said, well, you know, in America you have expensive children and you have cheap children. And that's kind of the way we're dealing with it. Well, tell me a little bit more about your year at Locke. And one thing I'm kind of curious of: do you think that that Green Dots, what are their prospects? Do you think are they going to come in and send 80% of the graduates to college as they're hoping to do? And the various stats that we read?
Well, I don't think right off the bat, but I would bet you that Green Dot would tell you there's nowhere else to go but up. And so I think they're feeling that Locke High School has been flatlining for a very long time, and if not flatlining, declining. So it's time for a change, and I think Green Dot thinks that their model, small, safe, local control, parental involvement will be the ticket. We'll see. I mean, they've set that bar very, very high. 80% graduation rate is not happening in LAUSD for sure, and in many suburban schools even. So let's see. It's going to be a daunting task, but if they do it, it will hopefully become a blueprint for how other big dysfunctional schools can be turned around.
Well, I have this sort of haunting fear that, I won't say you can't, but that it's extraordinarily difficult to change a school if you don't change the neighborhood. Because, I mean, just the very incident that you read and what we read about in the problems that teachers are dealing with in inner-city schools, schools don't create drugs. They don't create homelessness. They don't create unemployment. They don't create teenage pregnancy. They don't create gangs. Schools don't create those things, but they have to deal with them on a day-to-day basis. And then, you know, the public, I mean, one of the reasons why I hear people saying, well, you can't solve these problems by throwing money at them, or they'll say, well, you can't, you're just throwing good money after bad. But I'm not sure that you can dramatically change the schools without you know, changing the neighborhood.
Well, I think it's right. It's very difficult. But I really don't believe that we're in a position right now to fix the poverty or fix the neighborhoods or the dysfunction. And that, to me, you know, makes it all the more important that we fix our schools, because this, for many children, is the only place where there's stability and where they can be safe. And so I think it's kind of a cop-out to say, oh, well, we can't educate these kids. Look, they come from dysfunctional families and poverty and crime. Well, no, I think that's why we have to do it. And it is possible because there are models out there. We've seen it happen. You know, the KIPP schools are doing it, and some of the Green Dot schools are doing it. It can happen.
I hope. What I haven't seen yet, and again, this is another issue. I was at a meeting of a charter school management organization today, and one of the things that we really don't know yet is of the students that we get into college, how many of them are going to actually graduate from college? And, of course, then here's another issue where money comes into the picture, because in order to do a longitudinal study, you have to have the funds to do that. And, again, to give you the example of the $27,000 per pupil versus the $9,000, Crossroads School and every other private school in the United States, every, you know, sort of elitist private school, knows not only which colleges their kids enroll in their freshman year, they know which colleges and the graduation rate, and they know where those kids are for the rest of their lives, partly out of idealism and partly because they want us, you know, because they want them to contribute to the school for the rest of their lives. But they know where they are. Why do they know where they are? Because they have alumni offices. Mm-hmm. Who track them from the day they leave high school until the day they die, literally. And we don't know yet whether we're preparing kids to pass tests so that they can get into places where will they be able to survive? Do they have the critical skills to survive in some of the colleges that we're getting these kids into? I hope so, but we don't really know. Mm-hmm. And that's something, that's sort of one of the unanswered questions. And maybe when we have time for Q&A, maybe some of the people here will have observations on that. But I think that's one of the big unanswered questions mm-hmm. about charter school, the whole charter school movement. Every time I think of a reform, I have a hard time not putting a price tag on it.
Right. I do think, though, that the most important, crucial element in a child's education is human resources. I mean, I really do think that it happens, the magic happens between the teacher and the child. It's a binary relationship, and that's where I would want to see the focus, is attracting and training and selecting the highest quality teachers. And we have a model from TFA, actually.
Yeah. Well, you gave an example of a sort of a horror story of the student, you know, of the blackout and the student urinating in the class. I presume that you also saw some exhilarating moments where teachers had some breakthroughs with students.
Oh, sure.
Do a couple of those come, one or two of those come leaping to mind?
You know, they're little ones. It's lots of times it's just the look on a kid's face or the look on a teacher's face when they see the light bulb go off. But I know at the end of Taylor's year, Taylor was a ninth grade English teacher, her kids were explicating Romeo and Juliet, no joke. I mean, they knew this play. And not just facts, they understood it. in the context of their own lives, the Bloods versus the Crips. It was very powerful to watch that. And I saw similar kind of moments among all the teachers that I followed. And I think that's what keeps teachers teaching, are those special moments, because it's not the salary and it's not the working conditions.
Right. I wonder if there are there any TFA people in the audience here that have a particular exhilarating story that you might be willing to share with us yourselves of one of those great teaching moments. A hand, yes, great.
I had a moment the other day where a student that I had at the beginning of the year was actually put back in jail for the second time, and he came out of jail and went to meet with his probation officer and told his probation officer, I want to go back to the school that I had been at the beginning of the year. And so we met with him, and we told him basically, you're going to have to repeat seventh grade, you've missed most of the year. And he said, I want to do it. The teachers here care about me, and you know what, I want to be something, I want to make something of myself. And I was sitting there, the end of the year can be very tough, very trying, and was totally inspired by this child who's had just an extremely difficult year and was mature enough and thoughtful enough to make that decision and say, I want to do something with my life. So.
Yeah, that's exciting to hear. I
just want to jump in here. That the other thing that I quickly saw when I was at Locke is that these children do want to learn. You know, you always hear out there, oh, you can't teach these kids, and they're turned off, and you know they're too hard. And yes, some of them have very hard exteriors, but honestly, they do want to learn. It's in our DNA. You know, if you teach them, they will learn, and they deserve it. And you know, how could we sit here and let 30 out of 1,000 kids be eligible for college? You know, how can we rob them of that toehold on the ladder to success? It's mind-boggling to me.
Did you see examples in the classes that you sat in where, I mean, I agree with you. I think in any given class, the majority of kids actually do want to learn. But one of the things that I see happening is that there are a handful of kids, sometimes one or two in a given classroom, that make it almost impossible for the teacher to teach.
Yes, no, that does happen for sure. And you know, of course, the teacher has to deal with that. And probably the best solution is for that child to leave that classroom. But for the majority of students, and I'm sure all the teachers in this room would agree, then that's why you teach. It's so magical. It's so powerful. And these kids are so smart and so canny, so funny, you know, great kids.
The class sizes that you observed at Locke?
Big. In fact, Philip had a class in which there were not enough desks for his geometry class. And there was one kid who would come and he'd stand at the front of the classroom and he'd sort of wait to find a desk, knowing that there was no way that there would be a full class ever, never. Would every kid in the class show up. So this kid was very quiet and unassuming, and he just, you know, chill out until he found a seat. And Philip felt very strongly that he did not want to go to the administration and say, I need more desks, because what he needed were less desks, less children in the room, and so he didn't want to send the wrong message. But in the meantime, the kid had no desk.
Right. But we have $12 billion a month to spend in Iraq.
Right.
But we can't have desks and books for our students. Yes, I saw a hand back there. Here, we got a mic coming for you.
My name is Daphne Bradford. I'm a teacher at Locke High School, and we do have some students here today that came to listen to your conversation today. I don't know if any of them were in a TFA class, but one of my students he does have a question for you.
Great. Yeah, is that okay? Yeah, I think why don't we open it up for questions now, and so anybody, and we're going to, for the sake of the camera, we'll kind of start from the left here and then move over to the right.
How you doing? My name is Trayvon Lewis. I'm a junior right now at Locke. And my question for you is, why of all schools that you want to choose Locke to talk about?
So, I didn't hear the question.
I'm sorry. I said, why did you choose Locke?
Why did
Locke
I choose Locke?
Talk
about? I chose Locke because I knew Locke, and I also knew that Teach for America was going to have their training institute there. So I had visited the school, and I had heard from my friend a lot of things about Locke. So it just seemed like a natural place to go because this is where Teach for America was training its teachers.
So we're open for questions now. Yeah, here's another one.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. My name is Joseph Sherlock. I'm also a junior at Locke High School. And I wanted to ask Ms. Foote, what was the relevance of putting the stolen merchandise that Mr. Zeus Kubius received during the riots? What was the relevance of putting that in the book?
Did everybody hear the question?
Well, there's a part in the book where Zeus Kubius, who is a revered teacher at Locke High School, recalls his time during the Watts riots when it was the Rodney King riots, yeah. Well, when it was kind of a fire sale and people were helping themselves to merchandise. And Zeus did not steal any... It was just describing, I wanted to describe what the area was like during the Rodney King riots. And Zeus remembered it very clearly and described it for me. And so I thought that would be paint a very good, vivid picture of what occurred in the area around Locke at that time.
Questions over here, back there? Yeah, we'll get to you next then, maybe.
I was just wondering, how do you reconcile the Teach for America model of selection and attraction of high-quality talent to the classrooms with the unspoken elephant in the room of the importance of teacher retention and to maintain these high-quality, well-trained teachers that districts invest quite a lot of money in who then leave... most within 2 years and many within five, and I'm a TFA alum who's no longer in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile those two things that seem to be irreconcilable?
Well, it is a problem, and it's not teacher retention is not a problem peculiar to Teach for America. As most of you know, within 5 years, 50% of teachers are gone. So it is true that Teach for America in some schools can add to the problem of teacher churning, without a doubt. But again, I think nationwide, of the 3.5 million teachers, 14% leave the first year too, you know? So I don't think it is a problem, but it's not, as I said, it's not Teach for America. Everybody has it. Teachers are bailing, and no one can figure out a way to keep them, and which is why I think if we were able to attach status and prestige to our teachers and revere them and pay
demonstrate
them,
that with pay, yeah.
I think we'd see a sea change.
I think maybe some people saw, I think it was about 6 months ago in the New York Times, a charter school in New York where they're paying the teachers $125,000. I mean, that's kind of the goal. Every teacher, not just the ones who've been there for 20 years or whatever. In fact, there couldn't be because it was a brand new school. So everybody was going to get $125,000. And there was a book, I'm blanking on the author's name recently, The $100,000 Teacher. You have to, the way the system is now, you have to teach, you know, for your lifetime to get up to that number. So you're right. I mean, if we paid teachers, maybe they'd stay in. But I think we have to also ask ourselves, if Wendy Kopp hadn't founded TFA, and if TFA didn't exist, that would be a real loss in this country. And it's funded primarily with private dollars. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary contribution to the educational landscape. There was a question over here, and then right down in front here next. Right over there to your left, yeah.
My impression, though, is in most private schools, teachers actually have a lower salary than in public schools. How does that fit in with your description of $100,000 salaries?
Actually, the private schools that I know have done a pretty good job in the last 5-10 years in raising the salary scale. One that I know quite well starts at 52 now, and there are teachers in the 80s and 90s. But private schools have tended to lag behind public schools, play catch up, and then fall behind as public school salaries go up and then catch up. But the difference there is that the teaching conditions are so extraordinary that you would never leave that for a few thousand dollars to go and have 5 classes a day of 45 kids when you could have 4 classes a day of 15.
I would hope people would talk more about the systemic things rather than individual teachers, because I think even very good teachers cannot stay as teachers because of a lot of things besides the money.
Right. Yeah. I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just feeling being safe would be nice, too. I mean, there's a question right down here in the front, very front row.
I just want to make a comment, not a question.
Oh.
A friend of mine
here
is
we go.
A friend of mine is a teacher. And she's a retired teacher, so she wants to do substitute teaching. And she told me the other day, she came into this class, and the first thing this boy walked up to her and he says to her, "You're an old hag, and what are you doing in here?" He really insulted her. I mean, that was her hello for the day. How can you keep teachers if you have no respect?
That's a problem.
I know when I went to school, we revered our teachers.
Right. No, I agree. That's
and
terrible.
She wasn't the only one. The other night, I went to another event, and I was just talking to a lady I didn't even know, and she told me she was a teacher, and that a student was very insulting to her too. So, how do you keep these people?
Paul, do you know?
Well, I think that goes back to the whole notion that the problems we're dealing with here are not just the school's problems. They're neighborhood problems. They're community problems. If the teaching conditions were dramatically different, that kind of incident that you described wouldn't be possible. That kid would be out of the classroom very quickly and would be in some kind of a program where he would be taught some manners and so on. But
Ms. Foote, my question for you is, per a memo from Rochelle Snyder, she sent out a memo to all the Locke High School staff divorcing herself from the book because she was very surprised at the content of the book. And apparently, out of the teachers that you observe, she's the only one left there at Locke High School. How do you feel about that?
Well, that hasn't been communicated to me by Rochelle. I'm surprised to hear that. I don't know. You'd have to talk to Rochelle about that.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I sort of would like to hear a little more about what that is about. I'll just say that I volunteered at Locke this year with the college counselor, who unfortunately is not going to be there next year. And she worked very closely with the seniors and got a very good result. From about 125 kids are going to be going to school.
Right.
To college.
Mm-hmm. 8 got into UCLA, 8 got into Berkeley, a handful got into Santa Barbara, Merced, and I think what's unfortunate is that LAUSD is not going to give them green dot the money they had promised to have a college counselor for next year. But there's a great spirit there, and, you know, personally I think that it seems like it's
got a lot of students who really want to learn, like you said.
Oh, I love Locke High School, and I love the students, and the teachers that I met were unbelievable. There's lots of very good teachers at Locke High School. There's just not enough of them, and there's lots of great students too, and tremendous potential that has yet to be tapped.
Two questions down front.
I have questions about LAUSD. What would you do with LAUSD to try to fix it? Mm. And my next question is, did your presence in the classroom and at the school generally change the vibe in any way? Did your presence sort of create some of what occurred?
Well, I don't think so. I think after a while I was kind of like wallpaper, but Harag Hamalian is here, and Harag is one of the teachers that I followed, and maybe Harag could tell you if he feels I was students behaved differently because of me, but it wasn't my sense. I think they, you know, sort of after a while just forgot I was there. I'm sorry, I should have introduced Harag.
Absolutely not. We had many visitors coming in and out of the classroom, so the students were used to people coming in and out, and Donna was, like she said, just a wall on the fly. And so, fly on the wall, not a wall on the fly.
Harag taught biology and is now hoping to open his charter school next September. And next to Harag, I'd like to introduce Chad Solio, who was the assistant principal at Locke, and is now the principal at Ananimo, Pat Brown, and having very good results with his students.
LAUSD.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know what to say there. I think it's too big. It's dysfunctional. I think Paul would be a better person to address that. You've been in the trenches much longer.
Well, I think LAUSD is making an effort to respond. They're trying to create some more innovative projects. It's a huge district with huge problems. I sure wouldn't want Superintendent Brewer's job. I don't know what I would do given the limitations that office has. I would want to do the things that I've been talking about. I'd want to try and improve the teaching conditions for teachers, and I don't know how I'd do that in a climate where now you're looking at budget cuts, which is, here we have, what is California, the sixth or seventh biggest economy in the world, and we're talking about budget cuts for our public schools? To me, it's just insane. And all I hear is, it's as though people have forgotten that an economic balance sheet has two sides to the ledger. We just keep looking at the expense side and talk about what we can cut. And one of these days, we're going to have to wake up and look at revenue. I mean, I can sort of imagine myself going in front of the parent body at my old school, Crossroads, and saying, "Parents, and I've got some great ideas for improving our school. We're going to expand the curriculum. We're going to create better conditions for teachers, and we're going to do this by cutting tuition." And that's sort of the logic that we're applying to our public schools now. So as long as we're in that kind of a climate, I'm not sure what a large district like LAUSD can do with the kind of funding restrictions that they have. There was another question here.
I had a couple of points of clarification I think might help. I also teach at Locke High School, and I read the memo from Rochelle Snyder that went out to all of the teachers. As I interpreted it, she did not divorce herself from the book. She was very sensitive to some of the comments in the book. She wanted to make sure that she wasn't seen to be criticizing people who were there at the school now for some of the things that she might have said, but I didn't see her exactly dissociating herself from the book, at least as I interpreted it. Also about the college counselor back here, I was at a meet and greet on last Friday for the first time the new Green Dot teachers were collected, and I sat next to a young woman who was a TFA alumna. I was her faculty advisor, and she's telling me she's going to be the college counselor at Locke High School next year under Green Dot. So I also had a question, though, I wanted to ask Paul, my old headmaster. No. Now, Paul, you are familiar with, I assume you've read the book, and you're familiar with the Teach for America management philosophy in terms of a lot of data analysis and so forth. When you were reading through that, what did you think about that?
Well, in what respect?
Well, for example, how people within the organization get promoted, how teachers are assessed on the basis of data, and so on.
I don't know that I can really comment on that. I don't know how TFA operates well enough to make an intelligent observation there. I admire the organization tremendously, and I look at the number of quality teachers it's putting into tough schools, where if they didn't go there, I don't know who would.
Don't misunderstand. I'm not trying to get you to like criticize Teach for America or something. It's just that I know as a man who spent a lot of his life with a devote. You were a poetry teacher when I was at Crossroads, and the distinction between that and then the emphasis I read on measurable results and so forth strikes me as a very interesting.
Well, it is. It's a national problem right now. I think the emphasis that we put on testing. And probably every teacher in the room here will relate to the notion that what testing is doing is squeezing the joy out of education. And I think, it's probably the second biggest cause of driving teachers out of the field, second only maybe to pay, and maybe it's first, along with. It's part of the teaching conditions that I think demoralize teachers, is because they can't teach the things that passionately brought them into teaching in the first place, and to have scripted textbooks that to read from at certain grade levels is just anyway.
Once again, I'm Joseph Sherlock, a Locke High Junior, and before I ask my question, I would want to invite Ms. Donna Foote to, because I am the president of the MOLD, acronym for Men of Locke Delegation, which we hold our group. I mean, we hold our meetings every Monday at lunch to kind of shape our young black males and Latino males in the community to be outstanding citizens, to just learn how to be a man. Our slogan is, boys will be boys, but men must be men. And I'm also the vice president of the Black Student Union, the BSU, and I would love for you to come to our school and have a Q&A session.
Oh, I'd love to come.
I feel kind of, my school is kind of misrepresented in the book, and we only have Mr. Smith, one of our teachers, and just this group of students, and you kind of elaborated on some students that I know in the school, and they kind of felt the same way. But my question is, I have an excerpt from the Los Angeles Times called Rewriting the History of Locke High School. It's called Rewriting the Locke High School Story, and I'm going to read this excerpt to you because I want to clarify something. Well, I want something clarified. All right, here it is. When only 3% of Locke students are receiving the education required to get a toehold on the American dream, should we be surprised at a melee on the quad? After all, as education reformers would observe, if only 3% of the garbage in LA were being picked up, there would be rioting in the streets. So could you kind of clarify your metaphor to Locke High students rioting and the garbage on the streets?
Well, I didn't. I just meant that education of our young people at Locke High School is so important that a 3% rate of kids being eligible for college is absolutely unacceptable. And if something as trivial as garbage on the street were being picked up at that same rate, the mayor would be run out of town and there'd be rioting in the streets. I was making that point, I was making that comparison to show how terrible this is.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned 3%, because I just read a study recently done at the University of Chicago, where they took the top 164 colleges in America, and then they took the four quartiles of America economically, and they looked to see where the enrollment of those top 164 colleges comes from. And as you might guess, well, maybe, I mean, it was surprising to me to some degree, 75% of the enrollment of those 164 colleges came from the top 25%. 22% came from the next two quartiles. In other words, 97% of the enrollment of those 164, quote, top colleges came from the top three quartiles, which means that 3% came from the bottom quartile. And my guess is that of that 3%, probably 50% of them were athletes. So, you know, we've got, as a society, a long way to go before we can look to our low-income neighborhoods and neighborhood schools with a sense of pride and a sense that we're doing, that we're fulfilling our responsibilities as a society, because we're not now. So, yeah, let's move over to the maybe front row here. Do you want to just shout it out? And, oh, back here. Okay, great. And next year.
Yes, I'd like to know, once Teach for America goes to a school, do they continue to go there every 2 years with a new group? Is someone going to be at Locke from Teach for America?
It depends. The Teach for America teachers are hired like any other teacher. So, it depends on if there are openings and if the principal feels that the particular candidate is a good fit. So for the past several years, yes, there's been Teach for America teachers there every year, but it really is up to each individual principal to hire.
There's a question down front here.
Are you seeing
that? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, Donna, are you seeing that racial tensions between these two groups that you're talking about, Latinos and African Americans, at Locke and other schools, similar schools, are they getting worse or staying about the same? And how do teachers deal with that, and how does that affect their ability to teach?
To be honest, when I was at Locke, I didn't feel the racial tensions. I mean, you knew that, they existed, but I think the campus was very safe and well-maintained, and kids, students sit next to each other in class and joke, and, at lunch periods, they would segregate by interests but I didn't feel the tensions that much. I think this year has been difficult for the students at Locke because there have been a wider array of enrollments, so that there have been different rival gangs introduced into what was once a Crips-only school, and there's been less supervision, and there's been a sense, I think, from what I can tell from some of the teachers and students, of abandonment, because LAUSD is leaving Locke and Green Dot is coming in, and I think this transition year has been difficult for all, a lot of uncertainty.
There's four hands that are frantically waving in the back here. I think these folks want to weigh in.
Hello. My name is Reggie Andrews. I'm actually the senior staff member at Locke. There's no one been there longer than me. And it's actually my neighborhood where I can walk to my mom's house. And so the book kind of took me back. Locke has always been a media event. One thing that LAUSD has done is prepare our kids for failure. Social promotions goes on. You can fail four classes in the fifth grade and you'll still go to sixth grade. You'll fail two classes in the sixth grade, you'll still go to seventh grade. You can fail seventh grade English and math, and you'll still take eighth grade English and math. Then all of a sudden, Locke's got to fix it. That is the number one problem at Locke High School. It's not addressing that reality. So they've been, you might say, socialized for failure. Mm-hmm. So they may find out 2 years down the line that, oh, I'm not going to move up to the next grade. One of the interesting things that Green Dot is introducing for Locke next year is they're actually bringing the same concept in, because now the ninth graders who may fail two or three classes will be designated as 10th graders starting September, even if they failed classes. But that, I guess that might be a good thing. Teaching is a calling. I embrace and like the fact that Teach America teachers are coming to LOC because there's a big hole for teachers, people who are concerned. I don't think they're ready for the culture that they're going to walk into. And it was just interesting reading your book with a lot of those facts seem to be missing. And I think I could have written the same book about Beverly Hills High School and some of those stories. But LOC has always been a media event. And I would love for you to come to the school. And it's interesting that you wrote a chapter called The Men of LOC, an organization that I created, and you never talked to me. I just find that to be interesting.
I just want to kind of go more into the so-called racial tensions at my school. It's all just false propaganda. The day after the riot, the very next day, I was playing basketball with Latino students. I mean, we got along together so fine, like nothing happened. I mean, ever since then, if you were walk the campus right now, tomorrow at school, you would assume the same thing, that there nothing really happened. And when it comes to these, like, I mean, it's all a gang thing. You may have one gang of Latinos and one gang of blacks, and if you see them go at it and you see a big crowd around them, of course, you're going to kind of assume it's racial tensions, but it all comes down to a gang thing. If you're on the outside looking in, that's kind of what you assume of it. Oh, yeah, well, these blacks don't like these browns, but it's all the gang thing. And that's kind of false what you said about our school being predominantly Crip, because it's not. The biggest black gang at my school are the Bounty Hunter Watts out the Nickerson Garden, which are Bloods. And the biggest Latino gang from my school are the South Lows. And for what I see, because I've been on both sides of the fence, walking through the handball courts, the basketball court, in front of the band hall, which majority of the gangbangers hang out at, there are no such tensions or no racial tensions, no anything. When it comes down to a fight between a black and brown Latino, it is mostly a gang-oriented thing, or it's tagging. Anything related to gangs or turf is not have nothing to do with race, because some of my best friends, and I put emphasis on that, some of my best friends are Latinos, and we love each other. Oh, and also, it wasn't 600. I was there throughout the duration of the riot, the melee. I consider it more of a melee than a race riot, because it wasn't a riot. It was like kind of a free-for-all. Like, if I had problems with this gentleman here, and I couldn't be aggressive with him on school campus, so, hey, it's a big fight with, like, 50 students over there. I got my opportunity. It was a free-for-all. It was a melee. And it wasn't 600. It was probably about a little less than 100 students fighting. And it was just... yeah, it was just like big crowd, big spurses of crowd just going around just fighting each other randomly. So I just had to kind of put that out there for y'all. You know.
Thank you. Thank you. One more question, the lady.
No, I'm, you know.
Well, this lady here has been very patient.
Right. It would seem obvious to me that high school failure doesn't just happen at ninth grade. The children were socialized for failure. They were passed on and on and on. I would like to hear a comment how your school was socializing the children, and what were the offerings that you gave them to make them into successful high school students, versus what LAUSD is offering our students, because I have them in first or second grade, and they're not failures then. Something happens in between.
I think that's for you,
okay,
Paul.
Is that for me? Are you referring to private schools or to public schools? Because I've been working with... Well, I think, sure, one of the things that happens, I think, is that somewhere around middle school, things start breaking down when all of the, you know, the turmoil of adolescence hits. And one of the things that private schools do, again, because of the teaching conditions and the general culture of the school, they're able to keep the kids engaged. And so, and there isn't a gang culture surrounding the school, so you don't have to deal with that. There are kids who are going home primarily to two-parent families, families where both parents are college graduates, where there are books in the home, where the neighborhood is safe. I mean, the conditions are just dramatically different. And the richness of the curriculum keeps kids engaged so that you don't have 1,800 ninth graders becoming 700 or 800 12th graders. You, at Crossroads, you have 125 ninth graders, 125 seniors, 125 going to college the following September, and 125 graduating from college 4 years later. It's just it's a different world, and we have to face up to that and start giving the resources to inner city schools that kids just sort of automatically get in the more wealthy neighborhoods. And we need to say to ourselves as a culture that that both neighborhoods are equally important. And so far, we haven't been willing to say that. We've been willing to treat some neighborhoods as if they were throwaways. You know. So I guess that was the last question. And I think it's wonderful that you all came out, and Donna's to be congratulated for having given up a year of her life to going into this school and trying to assess the culture. And I guess you've been invited back.
Yes.
And thank you all very much for coming this evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.